Luis Carlos Serapio came to the United States from Mexico as an undocumented immigrant almost 30 years ago. Now he has his green card, has a family here, and he's created a website to help market his adopted hometown of Asheville to Latinx tourists around the world. It's called Descubre Asheville, a website that also claims to change perceptions of Latinx people. And Luis Carlos Serapio is my guest today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I want to talk all of it. You're very welcome, and I want to talk about your project. But let's talk a little bit about growing up in Mexico. What was that like? Where did you grow up, and what was it like for you?
Well, I was born in Veracruz. I was born in a very small town. The name is Poza Rica, Veracruz. And we traveled all over Mexico. We moved to different places. So I was only born there and probably lived there for 2 years. And we were on the move for many years.
You were in your late teens when you actually left home, right?
That is correct, yes.
How did your parents react to that?
Well, my mom was very encouraging in her own ways. She always wanted to travel. She always felt like she had very limited opportunities because she was a woman. So being her only son at the time, she wanted... Although she had two sons, but my brother was adopted and he passed. He never knew that he was adopted. But anyway, she will push me and will tell me that I was her only son and will try to push me to do things that she had dreamed of and she couldn't do.
And you talked about traveling around in Mexico for a while. That's because your father was following the work. What kind of work did he do?
My dad worked for the Mexican oil company, so he was working as a laborer when I was born. But he had gone to school, so he had somewhat of an education. He was a civil engineer, and he had also studied architecture. And because of that, I guess through his jobs as a laborer for this company, people realized that he had more capabilities and skills, and eventually he moved on in the company rather fast, I think.
So what
about, that's why we moved.
And that's why you moved. What about this move for you, this leaving home? Where did you go?
Well, when I finally came to the States?
Yes.
I came to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I took a bus from Puerto Vallarta, Jalisco, and it took, I don't know, maybe like 30-something hours of a bus ride to the border.
Well, tell us about the decision to go and, again, making that announcement. I mean, you talked about your mother wanting to perhaps live vicariously through you, be able to do things and see things she couldn't see, but that's a pretty dangerous trip, isn't it?
Well, yeah, definitely it was. But at the time also, being a teenager, I was very reckless, I guess. And I had a lot of desire of seeing the world. And I just thought that coming to the United States, that would be like the springboard for me to be able to do things that I couldn't do at home.
But what about, I'm wondering what kind of advice they gave you, because it's one thing to see the world, but again, you would have to enter the country illegally. It's not as easy
yes.
to get around. It's not as easy to leave the world. You can't just hop on a plane after that and go see Europe. You know?
You're right. So my dad would tell me, my dad loved me very much. He was very supportive, but he would tell me things like, in that country, even the dogs speak English. You don't even speak the language. I mean, you may know a little bit, but no, you shouldn't go. That's crazy. However, though, when he said that I was very decided and that I was going to do it, he helped me with some of the funds that allowed me to make it all the way here. However, though, he didn't really quite think that I was going to come to the U.S. He thought I was going to stay in the border on the Mexican side. And, I guess 2 days later after I have left home, I called him from L.A., I called him Collect, and he was very surprised. And I don't know, like he felt some kind of pain, I guess. He was worried about me.
Well, I want to talk more about that phone conversation, what he felt, what you felt at the time, and the feelings that you've had since. I'm talking to Luis Carlos Serapio, creative director of Descubre Asheville. It's a website that advertises Asheville to Latinx tourists around the country. We'll talk more about that. His travels in this country, all of that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Luis Carlos Serapio left home in Mexico when he was in his late teens And when he first came to the U.S., he was an undocumented immigrant. He has his green card now. He lives in Asheville. We'll talk about a website that he has that promotes Asheville to Latinx communities around the world. But we left you at the border in the United States, and we could hear in your voice you became emotional as you recalled the conversation with your father when he first learned that you were not at the border, not still in Mexico, but in fact in the United States. And he was obviously emotional at the time. What was your reaction to his response to you then?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I was very excited, and I tried to assure him that I was fine, that he didn't have to worry. The reason why now I believe that I get emotional is because I'm probably the age that he was when I left, and now I have kids. So now I don't even really have to imagine. I feel it. If my kids were to live, like to live for another country, being undocumented and going to this crazy adventure they want to pursue, it will be devastating. I will be very worried. But if I also was to see their determination that I could not stop them, how could I?
Well, let's talk about that determination and all that you have learned since. Let's talk about that crossing itself. How did you cross? To talk about crossing the border, what was that trip like and how did you do it?
Well, crossing the border was somewhat exciting. It wasn't scary back then, even though, I mean, I knew that many people don't make it. They either get arrested or they die or they get robbed and people get raped and things like that. So it was weird because, even though I knew that, my brain was not reasoning that. Mm. I guess that the drive was harder than any kind of fear. Literally speaking, the night that I crossed the border, it was it felt like it was in a football game. Hmm. And when I say football game, really, I'm talking about American football, your football. And because, you know, they have the guys that stop you, and you have the guys that will need to make it to the other side. And then it was very lit. There was a lot of lights, and there was a helicopter with the light and people. And there were, like, immigration officers and blazers, four-wheelers, and I don't remember what else. But for a kid like me, that was not scary. That was exciting. And I was like, okay, we're on. And and we crossed the river right in Tijuana, downtown Tijuana, I believe, is what it was. And we had to use garbage bags to cover our feet because the river there is very shallow. So you could actually do that. But the river is also really dirty because where the sewage goes. Mm. But anyway, we crossed. We were chased and we had to walk on the freeway. I don't remember if it's 101 or freeway 5, one of the two, really. And so we had to walk for a few miles to get to a spot where... we had to hide in the bushes, and at that point, the people that were actually doing this, the crossing of the border for people that were trying to make it here, said to us that we need to be quiet because gang members, usually Latino, Mexican-American gang members, will come and rob the people that they knew they would be hiding around there. So we had to be really quiet and try to hear for anybody coming.
And then the next step, you do have to then you did get into a bus or a car at that point. And then
yes, yes.
Talk about that next step, because that got a little bit dicier.
Yeah, you're right. Once again, being somewhat of a kid, not really be able to reason what was happening, when the people that were moving us around, I had paid at that point for somebody to take me all the way to L.A. And I had also told them, and this was a lie, that I had a family member that would pay them there. But I had the money with me. So we were a big group of people, maybe, and for me big, I guess I'm talking about 12 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So they came in two different cars, and the cars that they were driving, they were like those big old LTDs or something like that from the 70s or 60s, I don't know, those huge cars.
Right.
And they filled up the cars, the two cars, really fast. And since we couldn't all fit in it, I was one of the lucky ones to be put in the trunk with other people. So again, here I am right in the trunk with other people and still not really thinking too much about the craziness of that, just excited. And then, I don't know, a few hours later, because even though the border to LA is not so long of a time, these guys, I don't know how they were doing it or what, because, again, I was in the trunk. But it took us hours.
Well, it would have to seem like a lot longer drive in the trunk than it would in the back seat of an LTD, I'd say.
Well, you're right. You're right. But, I mean, I also remember that it was we had to wait in the bushes before the cars came for hours. Uh-huh. And then when we were in the trunk, I lost much of time because it was dark. Uh-huh. So finally, when they got me out of the trunk, there was daylight. And at one point, there was a spot for me in the car, not in the trunk anymore, because they had let go some people. And so that felt good, but also scary, because at that point I realized that my welcome into America was the site of Disneyland. So I knew I now know that it was Orange County, and it was either, I don't remember if it's it's Anaheim.
Anaheim, sure.
So I see the sign of Disneyland, and I just thought it was exciting because my dad always tried to take my oldest sister and me there. And that was kind of like a dream come true to see it. But then here I am in this car, and then I see that the driver is making a joint and he's also putting cocaine in it. And I only know this because that's where I can hear them talking and they're speaking Spanish. And that was scary because I was like, wow, these people are doing this. And they're driving, and I was in the trunk. And that's when I started realizing how dangerous that was.
And what a weird moment. I mean, here this promise as a child, this promise of someday seeing Disneyland. Now the dream comes true, only you're in the front seat or the back seat with the guys rolling joints and cocaine. That had to be a very strange moment for you.
Yeah, definitely. Again, I felt scared at that point, yes.
So you made it through, but tell us, because the trying to make it in L.A. was then, at that point, adventure meets reality, and it was no longer a football game anymore, right? Things became pretty difficult in L.A.
Definitely. Well, L.A. at the time, I believe it was 1990, and it was very dangerous downtown. I haven't been to L.A. in many years now, but back then it was scary to be there at night, especially at night. There was a lot of drug addicts. And to me, I have never seen that degree of people living on the streets and to being addicts. I mean, to me, that was, again, very scary. I think that the first night I rented a hotel room when I called my dad, I still had money. But then after that, I couldn't do that. And I went and stayed at one of the shelters, the homeless shelters. I would think that it was one called, Mission something on Main Street, I remember. And but then not every night I could make it there because the demand for the spaces was so high that sometimes I had to spend the night on the streets.
And I've heard you say that was one of the more surprising things to you, just confronting homelessness and the degree of homelessness here in the United States, which you had never really seen in Mexico.
Well, no. You know, what really was surprising to me is to see white people homeless. I have never seen a white person homeless in Mexico. Mm-hmm. In fact, in Mexico, anybody that is pretty white, imagine a white person here in the States. So we do have that kind of people in Mexico. A lot of people don't believe that, but we actually do. Those people usually hold a certain status in society in Mexico, and they are usually not poor. So to me, to see a white person that was homeless was bizarre. But then later on, I also realized that here, a lot of the homeless that I saw, they had some kind of either mental problem or addiction. Hmm. So anyway, but that I understood later on.
You found it difficult. Eventually, you did go back to Mexico, right?
I did. You're right. So after I was in L.A., finally, I made it all the way to San Francisco. And I don't know, I'm, at one point, I decided to go back to Mexico. I was disenchanted with the idea of living in the States. It wasn't really what I thought it was going to be like. So I went back, and I stayed there for a year. And over there, I met an American family who pretty much, I was working at a hotel in Puerto Vallarta. I was at the front desk. At that point, I spoke English. Not the way I do now, but I was able to get a job as a front desk guy. And so I met this couple whose last name is Drix. And they were great people. I didn't really know what to think of them when I just met them because they were so nice, and that was not my experience with people like them. And also, they seemed to be very curious about my English and how I have learned it. And long story short, they invited me to have breakfast with them, and during breakfast, they told me that if I ever want to come to the States, and go to college, they will help me to do that.
And they did. And that was in Utah, right?
That is right. That is right. So I showed up maybe like 3 months later. And actually, I wrote them a letter and I said that I was losing my job because it was only seasonal and I was thinking about going back to the States. So they told me, he called me on the phone. He called me while I was at work and he said, I got your letter and we got a room for you. You want to come? And they were not kidding. So yeah, I showed up and they pretty much had me living in their house for, I don't know how long, at least a year.
And you went to school?
Well, I did try to go to school, though, but that didn't happen because one of the things that I had told them, and that was a lie, is when I met them, when we were talking about me speaking English, they were somewhat impressed by me being able to speak English, I guess. And they asked me if I had a green card, and I had said yes, and that I had a social security number, but again, that was a lie. So when I actually showed up at their house again, they tried me to get me enrolled and they tried to get me a job, but pretty soon they found out that was not possible.
What did you do next?
What did I do next? Well, I became very desperate. I was very ashamed that I had lied to them and they were going to find out. And because the job that they had got me, they told me, hey, so we're trying to enter the social security number you gave us and it doesn't work. And so I basically walked away and I went into a church. And in that church, the mother of the governor of Utah was doing her mission. And she happened to be the person that started talking to me. And I basically broke down and told her what had just happened. And she called him and said, hey, so we have a guy here that lives with you guys. And just in case you're wondering where he is. And sure enough, they came, and it was very sweet. It was it was a really moving experience.
And you eventually, this is where you met the woman who would become your wife, right?
That is right.
Tell us about that.
Well, I met a girl at the local college. I was actually now trying to study English and English as a second language because my English was good, but I guess I was trying to get better, really. It wasn't as good as it is now. And she was teaching English as a second language with a different group. We're beginners. So it wasn't quite my group, but I don't know. She seemed cool, and she was about my age. And next thing you know, we were dating.
You got married, and eventually you applied for your green card, right? So tell us about all of those steps and you know, what that was like for you.
Well, at the time, there was a way to do it that I could still do that. But it wasn't easy and it wasn't fast like most people think. A lot of people think that when you marry an American citizen, you by default you have some kind of a status that allows you to be here, which is a lie. That doesn't happen. I don't know when that happened, but it's a legend, an urban legend type of thing it's very rooted in the mentality of a lot of people. So we applied for them. For the adjustment of my status, and I had to pay a fine because of the fact that I had entered the country undocumented. So during that time, they made some kind of a window period where people could do that, and that's how I was able to do it. Otherwise, they would have sent me back to Mexico, and I would have had to apply from there.
Now, did the fact that you were married to an American have anything to do with that, or was there any part of that that made it, if you had not been married, for instance, and had gone through the same process, could you have gotten a green card?
No, you're right. Yes, it did help a lot, and that was the only way that I was able to achieve my green card. But what I'm trying to say is that it's not just as easy. You just get married, and they will do it right away, and that it will be an easy, smooth ride.
It's not automatic, and you did pay a fine for...
You have to pay a fine, and of course, you have to... That's just part of it, and you have the processing fee of everything else, and it was a period... It's a process that lasted a long time.
You did get your green card. That means you are now here legally, and you moved around the country a few times, right? You moved several places, but eventually you ended up in Asheville, right?
That is right.
Tell us about what brought you to Asheville.
I was living in New York, and I had worked for a guy in West Virginia who was a young guy when I met him, and he had a partner with some other guy from Tallahassee, and they had opened this business that it was a they had a niche. They were making copies, but it was somehow they were just targeting lawyers. And anyway, they were paying me a decent amount of money. I put a lot of hours. They saw my work ethic. And then years later, when I was not working for them, and I was working in New York, I was working for H&M, the clothing company, they called me back, or one of them, the guy that, he was living in Greenville, South Carolina. He called me and said, hey, so this company that you're working for, when they called me to get a reference from you, I remember you and I want you to come back and work with me. And I said, well, okay. And he told me, look, I can pay you this much. I think there is this town that you may like a lot because, again, him and I, we were not friends. He was a good boss and he always kept his distance. But we would talk about a lot about politics. And I think he was somewhat fascinated by some kid that he's from Mexico that will be so into following what was going on in the country. And we will have interesting conversations because of that. So he offered me a job here in Greenville with the promise that he was going to open a branch in Asheville, North Carolina.
It was a coffee shop, right?
It was a coffee shop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, but that didn't work out quite the way either he had planned or you expected, right?
That is right. And he wanted me to stay in Greenville, South Carolina for a longer time than just the 6 months that he had promised me to be trained. And I stayed up to a year. And when my lease was up, I told him that I did not want to stay there. And my choices were to stay there one more year with him or to quit. So I quit. And it was crazy because I was making $50,000 when I was 28 years old with no college degree. And, and now I see how crazy that was that I just quit it. But at the same time, I don't regret it. I mean, I love Asheville. And I came here and I started working as a waiter.
You're leaving, you know, bird in the hand here. And what was it about Asheville that made you think it could be better than what you were getting in Greenville?
Well, have you ever been to Asheville?
I have, and I've been to Greenville. So I absolutely affirm your decision. However, you know, it's easier for me to get a job. So I wonder about that.
Okay. Well, again, I was still somewhat young, I think.
Greenville, by the way, I just have to interrupt. Greenville, South Carolina. For those of you who might have thought I compared good old Greenville, North Carolina to Asheville, I didn't just do that. I was talking about Greenville, South Carolina.
That's
okay,
right.
Carry on.
I really want to live in this town. I thought it was a beautiful town. I like, I'm going to sound very Asheville, okay? But I like the energy.
Yeah.
I like the people here. And also coming from New York, I was very amazed and surprised by the willingness of the people to be nice to each other. I remember really, even before I moved, I came from New York and I didn't have a quarter for the parking meter. And somebody that saw me that I was looking for change just gave me some quarters. And I just thought this will never happen in New York. So little things that made me want to be here. And the mountains are beautiful.
Well, we'll talk more about that, the beauty of the mountains, all the reasons that Luis Carlos Serapio wants to be in Asheville and why he thinks other Latinx community members would like to be there as well. He encourages them to be there and encourages the rest of us to have a better and deeper understanding of our immigrant labor and neighbors. We'll talk to Luis Carlos Serapio some more on the state of things in just a few moments. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest is Luis Carlos Serapio, creator of Descubre Asheville, a website that advertises Asheville to Latinx tourists, also showcases Latinx professionals as bloggers. Before we get to that, you came to Asheville, and eventually you started your own or got into business for yourself, right?
Yeah, that is right.
Tell us about that business.
So what happened is my first wife and I, we have talked about doing a business for the longest time. And first, we thought it was going to be some kind of restaurant. But I don't really like restaurants. My mom had one, and it was a lot of work. And I also know people that are in that business, and it's like it's too much work.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of the people that are in that job, they don't really have time for their family. So no, eventually, we felt like the culture here in Asheville, they were attracted to people that were different. And because of that, I thought maybe we can start bringing some things from Mexico. And yes, we opened a little shop right here on Lexington Avenue, and we start selling ceramics from Mexico and also some kind of religious paintings with a Catholic theme that were very colonial Spanish looking. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of like the start of all this. From there, we went from 800 square footage to 6,000 square footage. And then we start buying furniture. And then next thing you know, I was traveling to India. I was traveling to Indonesia. I was traveling to Central America and buying a lot of, we were buying a lot of things, bringing containers of merchandise. We were able to sell to some of the businesses downtown Asheville that were, and they are, owned by Latino entrepreneurs, and those businesses have become very, very successful.
So that was going very well, and then the recession hit, right?
You're right. The recession hit, and the business really, the model was aimed at people that, yeah, that their income was somewhat high because what they were buying was the uniqueness of what we were selling. But people could not even afford their houses, never mind a piece of furniture.
So tell us about that, because eventually you became a court interpreter, and that was not something you expected to do. Tell us more about that.
That is right. So when the world crumbled of sorts and people were losing their jobs and I also had to close the business, I found myself in this position where it was desperate. And then people were talking about recession and the people that were losing their jobs were talking about depression and feeling that and the pressure of now I was going to be a dad or my daughter had just been born. I stumbled up into this opportunity. I met this lady, Mari Ontiveros. You were listening, licenciada. Thank you very much for everything you've done for me. So she helped me to basically get into the court and see how it is that it works and what I needed to do to be able to achieve work in there. So she was a big mentor.
Well, tell us about that, because you're talking about interpreting, right, for these might be people who are in court who speak only Spanish, and you're having to do the work of interpreting the court to the individual and back and forth, which sounds like a big responsibility. What kind of education do you need for that?
Okay, so court interpreters are not many, and the job pays well. And the reason why there's not too many, or there's rather high demand for them, is because, yes, you have to be bilingual, English and Spanish, but beyond that, you have to learn a third language of sorts, and that is the language of the courts. And not only you have to learn it but in English, but you also have to learn it in Spanish. And you have to be able to not make mistakes. And so the tests are really, really hard. They're not – if you were to go to their website and you were to see the info of the people that passed this test, the percentage is really low. Mm. And so, yeah.
Well, it seems like an interesting challenge, too, as an interpreter, because it seems to me that a lot of people who speak English would need an interpreter to understand what the lawyer and the judge are saying because they're speaking in these technical terms. How much responsibility do you have to sort of explain what that means, even if you have the Spanish term for it, which a lot of people might not have heard either, right?
You pretty much just answered that on your question, but I'll break it down. So you're right. I cannot do that. I'm just an interpreter. If you need somebody to explain something to you, I'm going to tell you before I start talking to you, if you don't understand something I'm about to tell you, that you need to address the judge, the DA, or your lawyer, and get them to tell you, and I will be interpreting right behind them or while they are talking to you if we have equipment and you can hear me simultaneously speaking with equipment, what is going on. But I am not allowed as an interpreter ever to explain anything to anyone. And that's the misconception a lot of people think. They think an interpreter is an advocate. An interpreter cannot be an advocate.
That's fascinating. I mean, I'm just wondering if you're in the situation where, you know, you translate something into Spanish and the individual looks at you and says, what's that mean? Can you turn to the judge and say they want to know what it means? Or do they have to say, please ask the judge what that means?
They have to tell me to please ask the judge. But if I do, as an interpreter, perceive that there's some kind of misunderstanding, I can then follow the protocol of the courts and tell them something like, Your Honor, the interpreter would like to clarify or find out what this means or something like that. Something that will let them know that the interpreter is not quite sure what's going on or the defendant or whoever it is.
Where did you get this? So how did this go? I mean, it sounds like this is an awful lot of pressure in a lot of ways. Did you enjoy this?
Well, yes and no. I enjoy it because through the program, I've been able to make my vocabulary richer. But no. I do not like to work for the courts. I do not. I mean, I feel like the system needs to change, and things that that I don't agree with, I have to hold back to it. And no, it's not something that I enjoy.
Fascinating, though. I mean, you get an even deeper insight into sort of how things work and don't work for who's ever in front of that judge. It seems to me.
Well, you're right. But again, I feel like at this point, I understand that it's always good to have a lawyer, basically.
That's the answer. Well, so talk about Descubre Asheville and how you what it is and how you came to this idea.
Well, Descubre Asheville exists in a big part because of a guy that I met that actually believed in me. And you are listening, Boomer. This is about you, my brother. So Boomer Sussman has a company here in Asheville that is called Big Boom Design. And when I had a meeting with him and I explained to him what it is that I wanted to do, he thought about it for a few days and they came back with a positive answer. And it was a big deal for me because I had actually approached other companies that do the same here in Asheville. And they would look at me like, I don't know, like I was on drugs or like they just couldn't believe that Latinos could actually come downtown Asheville and, I don't know, go to a nice restaurant or go to one of the breweries.
Well, again, spell out the idea for us. What's the plan here? And it was an idea when you lay it out for us, because I think you had seen an example of this sort of thing, this kind of marketing plan, essentially, in one of your last trips to Indonesia, right?
You're right. So when I was in Bali, I met this Englishman who we were at the same restaurant, and we started talking. He heard my accent. I told him I was from Mexico. And he told me he lived in Mexico. And I said, well, what are you doing in Bali? And he told me that he also lived in Bali. And I thought that was fascinating that an Englishman could live in tropical places that were so far apart. And then he ended up being a person that did advertising. And he told me that he was going to make a pitch to the city of Singapore about this website. And I thought that was fascinating. And then he asked me what I was doing, and I told him that the business that I was in and that I was making some furniture in Bali, that's what I was traveling there. And he thought that was cool, but he told me that I work a lot. And I thought that, I thought he was right, but I also was getting nervous because I was, that the recession was about to happen.
So now tell me how that becomes Descubre Asheville and what it is you are trying to achieve.
Okay, so Descubre Asheville has a few goals, but the main one, one of the main ones will be for people that are not Latinos, American entrepreneurs, business owners, to realize how they're overlooking and underestimating a market that is very powerful. And I think that, again, the fact that Asheville is now becoming an international travel place, when you see it in National Geographic, when you see it in Outside Magazine, when you see it in GQ Magazine, you see it in the New York Times, and all these places that advertise Asheville as the place to be. And also, you were to go to those places, New York or any of the other big cities, you can go to neighborhoods or areas of New York, and you can see advertising in Spanish by brands like Reebok, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, H&M, whomever. So they understand that we are a powerful demographic and that we are more than just laborers or construction workers or people that don't have the means to be able to have the purchasing power that everybody else has. So in other words, we come in different shapes and different jobs and different levels of education. So that's what I'm trying to make them see.
The goal is that you can market Asheville to a Latino audience and have them come and visit Asheville. But on the one hand, this is sort of like delivering lambs to the slaughter, isn't it? I mean, you're asking people to come and spend their money. What's the benefit to the Latino community in this kind of marketing?
Okay, good. So again, you change the perception of the Latinos. You actually get them you treat them like a normal person, number one. And number two, part of the funds that the people are paying to advertise in this website, I am trying to develop a scholarship. This scholarship, the first year, I wanted to give it to a Latino student, and I want them to be able to achieve to become a core interpreter. Because to be a core interpreter, if you study really hard, even just with a high school degree or a GED, you could be making anywhere from $35 and up. So I don't believe nobody is going to pay you that kind of money with only a high school education and a certificate as a as a court interpreter. So I think it's a great opportunity to be able to empower somebody in my community. Now, the goal is that the more businesses that join, either the scholarship grows and it's no longer just to be an interpreter, or we can actually get an African-American also to be a sponsor in some way with the same kind of amount of money that we will give to a Latino. And this is the way that I will try to make it more inclusive. And the more the company grows, then we will add one more recipient for this scholarship, and it will be somebody from the LGBTQ community. And I want to do this because that way I want to show the world that Discover Asheville, it is really about making something inclusive, not just Latinos. It's just I'm just using the two languages, English and Spanish, because the website is bilingual, for them to get that point so that people that don't speak Spanish read what it is that is going on there too.
Yeah, and it seems like the other part of this, and you said that, but I want to sort of underscore this, that for the business community there in Asheville, the idea is for people who may have had only one idea and one vision of what it meant to be a Latino immigrant in this country, or Latino in any case as part of that community, you want to suggest that it's a much broader population than that, with a lot more diversity than we might think otherwise.
Sure, sure. Part of the way that I'm doing this is like a bunch of the bloggers that are blogging with me now that are bilingual. I have I have people that are actors. I have people that are, there's an architect. There is a professor. And people that are selling real estate. And all of those people are bilingual. So they do change the perception that other people have of our community. Because for some reason, I feel like Americans think, what they think, immigrants from Latin America, they think a labor, a maid, or something like that. But again, here with the profiling that I'm putting off the bloggers, I'm hoping that people see they're actually more than that. One particular occasion that something happened to me when I went to eat here at Green Life during lunch, I had just gotten up from the courts, so I was wearing somewhat of a suit. Now, this white American lady, probably, in her 60s, really nice, came to me and, she said hi and started talking to me, like, really nicely and asked me at one point if I was a doctor. And I said that I wasn't. I did have my computer out and I was working on translation. And she asked me, what did I do? And I told her that I was an interpreter, a court interpreter. And she asked me if I was from India. And I said, no. But then basically the whole point about that is that she thought, because the way I was wearing somewhat of a suit and I had a computer, a laptop there, and that I had a certain look, that I could not be Mexican, that I could not be Latino. So
this is one of the ideas that you want to, and I would think for the business people who are advertising, it's a change in perspective for them. It's something perhaps they hadn't thought about. What about the bloggers? You talked about the fact that many of the people who are creating these articles that are part of the website, and they're sort of making the appeal to other members more broadly, are professionals themselves. Is there anything different in the appeal? Would it be the same kind of thing that we would that you would promote in the same way, and the same kind of things that you would promote to a white audience, to a non-Latino audience?
Yes, the same kind of things. Again, the best example that I can use here, I feel like, is Beer City USA. Asheville is Beer City USA for many years. Now, it blows my mind that the breweries here don't realize that many times when the Mexican national soccer team comes to play in the U.S., a bunch of times the sponsors of these events are companies like Anheuser-Busch or Coors Light, and that they are investing in this market. So again, I feel like I don't know, that something has to be done, and that's the kind of content that I'm writing about beer. I'm writing about, or we're writing about food. We're writing about things that resonate with people here, permaculture, wellness, anything, you name it. Just make it bilingual.
How do you see the future of Descubre Asheville?
I see it growing. I see it bright. I do see that people will open up to it. I do think that people are opening up to it, and I believe that this is the reason why you and I are talking right now. So thank you.
I am speaking with Luis Carlos Serapio. He is the creator of Descubre Asheville. He is also a court interpreter. And you can find out more about Descubre Asheville at our website, stateofthings.org. Luis, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. Tomorrow on the State of Things, we're going to be talking about North Carolina families struggling to access a specialized treatment for their children with autism. It is made available to them by law through health insurance companies, but many families are falling through the cracks. We'll talk about what's going on there on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.